This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Podcast. It is the final day of half-term Luke Jones before class. And Smoking Behind the Shed resumes with Matt on Monday. Today on the podcast, the Blair Referendum Project. Two Blairs who ran campaigns in the first Scottish independence referendum, Blair Jenkins from Yes Scotland and Blair McDougall from Better Together, will reflect on lessons learned and what might happen if there's a second Scottish independence referendum. First, though, our columnists, Esther Webber and Robert Crampton. Right, both. The matter of business. So later today we're going to hear this big speech from Sir Keir Starmer setting out his vision, some economic policy. Esther Webber, I read somewhere, I think the Labour List was describing it as lengthy.
Yeah, that makes it sound like a bit of an ordeal, doesn't it? But I think the point that was trying to be made there by Keir Starmer's supporters is that this is something of substance, it's something hefty, and it's something for people to get their teeth into to show a bit more of what Labour's direction is and what they want to achieve, which is obviously something they've come under a bit of criticism for over the past few weeks, and particularly the message today is about focusing on the economy and saying that Labour can be a party which is responsible with the country's finances. So I think that's the message they're looking to put forward today.
And Robert, do you think that this will do the trick? Does a big set piece speech mean that Keir Starmer all of a sudden work will cut through if he hasn't been already?
I suppose it's the beginning of that process. I mean, no, one speech seldom makes much of an impact, especially at the moment. But he's got to start somewhere. We're starting to see the return of business, well, politics as usual. I mean, it's being foreshadowed that you can see that happening. And he's trying to say, I mean, it's 10 years now since Labour was in government. Their famous, you know, the money's run out note, which hung over them for a decade. He needs to banish that. But at the same time, he's talking about making a more equal society, which means spending money. So it's a difficult circle to square. Where, you know, we're going to be financially responsible and sensible, but we're also going to pay public sector workers more and invest more and level up and all the rest of it. So it'd be interesting to hear what his thoughts are on that.
Esther, I keep seeing this prefaced with the phrase, Keir Starmer has had a bad few weeks, he's had a tricky start, there are murmurings about his leadership. Is any of that right?
Well, I mean, with any sort of polemical point, I guess, about the leader, it can be taken too far, and maybe the case has been overstated in the past few weeks. But it's definitely true that you didn't have to travel very far to find Labour sources willing to complain about the lack of energy or definition at the top of the party. Those are the kind of gripes we were hearing. And I think also some people would call attention to the polls and the fact that he has fallen behind Boris Johnson as most liked for Prime Minister in recent weeks for the first time in a long time. But, you know, to give the other side, we are, as far as we know, a long way out from an election, and it's not unusual for the polls to kind of dance around level pegging at this stage.
Well, Keir Starmer's speech is at 11. We will lovingly fill it some best bits for you at 11:30 with some live analysis, so you don't have to sit through the whole lengthy thing. Robert Crampton, the other story which I'm keen to ask you both about is the toing and froing in the cabinet. Lord Frost now working his way up to a cabinet position, usurping Michael Gove, lots of cabinet criminology, which I'm not sure I can quite make sense of.
Well, Esther would know more about this, but I think I'm right in saying that a couple of Gove's people, as it were promoted recently. And this is obviously Boris. This is Boris hitting back, isn't it? I mean, it's Boris does not trust Michael Gove. Presumably, he'd be a fool if he did, given what Gove did to him a few years ago when he was running, going to run for leader the first time. So, he's lost Cummings. So, obviously, Boris has brought his own man in.
Oh. Esther?
Michael Gove's been a fascinating figure so far in this government, although still a bit kind of shrouded in mystery, because he has been leading so far in government on Brexit preparations, which is obviously a massive job. But there are many parts of government business he isn't connected to. He's also closely involved in strategizing on the future of the union. So even though this has been interpreted as a bit of a kick in the teeth for him, the fact that this Brexit responsibility within cabinet would be transferred largely over to Lord Frost as the new minister, even that having been said, some people are seeing as possibly this opening the way for another job for Michael Gove, for something more prominent. And also his people close to him are saying he was supportive of this appointment. So basically, if you're trying to work out who's up and who's down, good luck to you.
Well, assume, Robert, that Michael Gove is up, and as I said, there was some suggestion in the paper this morning that it might be that he's being lined up to be Home Secretary or Health Secretary in the near future. What would you make of that?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Like Esther says, what he does is shrouded in mystery, and you kind of get the impression that maybe he does everything. He kind of does the bits that Boris doesn't want to do, which is the detail, and obviously that is very useful for Boris, but he doesn't want to see him getting too powerful, I guess. So what do I make of that? Being Home Secretary. I mean, he's what's he done? He's done education, he's done justice, he's now done Brexit, I think he's done a lot of the pandemic stuff. So yeah, maybe it's time for him to have a look at that. Esther, you know more.
We're still a way off from a reshuffle, I think, because the consensus seems to be that we need to wait until this immediate phase of the crisis has passed. His position within any reconstituted cabinet will be absolutely fascinating to see. And I guess even though he has been at the top of government for a long time, he hasn't done any of the big four jobs yet.
And of course, there is still a pandemic brewing and continuing. You both want to touch on that in different ways. Robert, first of all, your column this Saturday is going to be about a routine appointment at dermatology. But I imagine how confusing, how difficult was that in a global health emergency?
Well, it was surprising. It was amazingly easy. I was just getting a mole checked out, and which is absolutely fine. And it took me to my local hospital, and I was just incredibly impressed by how I know there's this terrible backlog of people who haven't been seen for various things much more serious than mine. But I was just impressed at the speed of the appointment, the fact everything was so efficient and calm and on time, and it was great. And that's kind of what I'm writing about, but with it because it's a light-hearted column. There are inevitable hilarious consequences as well, so.
Such as
I must have been more nervous than I thought, because as I approached the receptionist, the back of her computer was facing me, and I got it into my head that she was called Lenovo, because the branding on the computer was that it was exactly the same height as where a name tag would have been on her shirt. And I said, "Oh, hello, Lenovo. How are you?" Luckily, we both had face masks on, and I think she just chose to ignore that, which is very wise.
She just thought he's not well.
He's not well. So although I was fairly sanguine, I thought I was fairly sanguine about it. I was obviously more rattled than I thought.
Good grief! And Esther, you want to talk about this max COVID vaccination plan for prisoners and staff, and how prisoners could be vaccinated before large swathes of the population, and this is being considered by governments at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting story, and we've got a piece in Red Box today from one of the charities that helps try and prevent reoffending NACRA, and they're also calling for prisoners to be given priority. And that view is put forward in the story by health experts as well. You say there's a sort of similar public health case to care homes, in that you have a lot of people living all in close quarters who are going to easily spread it if they get it, and also lots of people with other conditions or traits that can make them vulnerable. But it's a really interesting one in terms of the politics, because care homes is kind of a no-brainer in a way, in theory. Prisons would obviously be highly controversial. And it's interesting to see whether the government will resist that.
Because that would be a hard sell, wouldn't it, Robert? I mean, I remember when the Sun had on the front page the fact that Levi Belfield had been, the murderer had been, had a letter to say that he could be expecting a vaccination.
Yeah.
People were up in arms about that. It's a very kind of thing that gets people angry.
Well, yeah, and looking at the below the line comments on our piece today, a similar reaction. People saying, the consensus is basically vaccinate the prisoners. That was the thrust of it.
And you can't really imagine a Home Secretary less disposed to go for that than Priti Patel.
But that is the next thing for us all to argue about, isn't it, Esther? The what happens post the nine priority groups. And I know it has been suggested in some of the reporting that actually we'll just continue down the ages, but there will still be more louder and louder calls for police officers or teachers or whoever to jump the
queue. There will definitely still be arguments over this, and we had a poll in Red Box this week about asking people who they thought should be given priority, and there was a majority, just over 50% for teachers. Quite a lot for police officers as well, I think 25%, a bit less for soldiers. Right down the bottom, I'm sorry to report, was MPs, who only 1% thought MPs should get priority.
And what about you, Robert? Did you think there's a case for profession? And
it's a tricky one. I mean, I'm 56, so I think I'm in group 9, but if somebody said to me, "Oh, there's this 40-year-old teacher who needs a vaccination ahead of you, I would find it hard to argue that she shouldn't have it. Similarly, a police officer or, I mean, frankly, a lot of people would probably be, you know, more vulnerable, more exposed than I am. And I'm, but I would, as things stand, I would be due to get it before them. So yeah, it's going to be, it's an argument. It's going to be a big argument. And this, and the, I mean, the prison one is, I mean, the politics of it, as Esther says, are just absolutely horrible, aren't they? To say that some awful person, bearing in mind that most people in prison are not awful people. I could argue that most people in prison probably didn't ought to be in prison in the first place. But the ones that do deserve to be there, they, yeah, I mean, that's a very, yeah, hard sell is putting it mildly.
That was Esther Webber and Robert Crampton. More from them in the paper. Remember, you can pick up a copy or subscribe online. Next on the podcast, the Blair Referendum Project.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Should I stay or should I go now?
What with Brexit, the pandemic, this recent SNP split over Alex Salmond, the comings and goings of Scottish Tory and Labour leaders, the expectation of and discussion around a second referendum has grown louder and louder. Something reflected in the polls. It wasn't too long ago that the Sunday Times had that poll showing a majority in Scotland want to be asked about independence again. The Holyrood elections in May and the expected SNP majority, of course, could be the firing pistol. But what would IndyRef2 look like? Well, we've the two men who ran the Yes and No campaigns in the last one in 2014. In a moment, Blair Jenkins, who ran Yes Scotland. First, though, Blair McDougall, who ran Better Together. In a half hour, we're calling the Blair Referendum Project. Firstly, is IndyRef2 even likely?
I think on balance, it probably won't happen anytime soon. And I think there's lots of reasons for that. One is that I think it suits both the SNP and the Conservative Party to kind of tilt at each other on this issue. It means they don't have to, either of them, talk about their domestic records. And so they can have this argument about identity and flags, and it pushes Labour off of the map. I think the more honest reason why I don't think we're going to have an independence referendum anytime soon is that the SNP government haven't done any of the kind of intellectual renewal of their case since 2014. So the public finance position has completely changed. Their position on currency has completely changed. Brexit means that they can no longer claim that the EU provides a seamless border between England and Scotland. And none of those big issues have been even begun to be addressed by the SNP. So I think there's a lot of theatre around it at the moment. Now, it could be because of the sort of Salmond-inspired civil war, that Nicola Sturgeon slightly loses control of events and finds herself pushed into, you know, maybe a stance that is less cautious than her instincts are. But I think on balance, it probably isn't going to happen in the immediate future.
But for the sake of this programme and item, I'm going to get you to indulge in our parlour game of if it is afoot. But before we do, could you lay out for us, for anyone who doesn't know, what your role was in the first one?
I was sort of tapped up to run the Better Together campaign. So I was the chief executive. I set up the Better Together campaign, which was the cross-party no campaign in 2014.
And what would you say went well from that? If you were going to have to replicate that campaign for another independence referendum, what would you wholesale copy?
There's lots that's changed, but the thing that's remained the same is that in Scotland you have these two very noisy tribes either side of the spectrum kind of shelling each other, and they're doing that over the heads of, you know, about a million undecided voters for whom this isn't really the passionate issue that it is for the people on the extremes. And I think the thing we got right in 2014, and it'll be something that someone else would have to do, were there another referendum, is to keep that sort of laser focus on those undecided voters for whom this isn't really about flags and identity. It's about a pragmatic choice about whether they will be better off or worse off from exiting the United Kingdom. And so I think that strategic focus was the thing we got right. And that kind of led to us being labelled as being a bit boring, a bit prosaic, and maybe the Yes campaign was more poetic, but...
It would be not just boring necessarily, but it was also two head, two hearts was the thing you heard a lot. And I wonder if you'd try and be a bit more heart.
I think there is an emotional case to make, but I think what people who want to remain in the UK shouldn't mistake that for is that the case is about Britishness. Because for those voters in the middle, if this is a contest about national identity, if that's what the frame of a referendum is about, then the side which wants to stay part of Britain loses, because you're asking people to choose between two identities.
What about the branding of the campaign? There's a lot of worry. If you're the no side of a referendum, it's quite hard to spin that as a positive. You had the whole no thanks thing going on for a bit. Mm. Do you think you nailed that in Independence Referendum 1? And would you want to change how you approached it in Independence Referendum 2, where it's happened?
Well, we were conscious of that, which is why in the first phase of the campaign, we were better together. And the idea was we would transition into... if you like, a more complete sentence, which was no thanks, we're better together, a kind of polite decline to the nationalist proposition. I think there's actually an open question this time as to whether it would be yes or no this time round if there was another referendum. The Electoral Commission have to test the question, and when they tested a yes-no proposition for the Brexit referendum, they found that having a yes-no proposition they didn't feel was balanced. So it would be interesting this time round to see if the Electoral Commission stick with their previous research from the 2016 referendum.
What about the decision to bundle all the unionist parties together under one campaign? Is that something which you'd want to see happen again if IndyRef 2 were to happen?
I think it's important to understand that in 2014, yes, the parties worked together, but that was really a legal necessity. So under the law that governs referendums, if you want to spend money in the short campaign, the last few weeks of a campaign, you have to be a designated organisation. And to be a designated organisation, you need to demonstrate a broad support. So there is still a need for something which is either cross-party or non-party. I think it's more likely, if there is another referendum, that it would be non-party rather than cross-party. That is to say, you would see some political figures coming together. So I think if there was another referendum, I think it's likely that it would be a different beast. And actually, given the way politics has changed, given the way the state of the parties in Scotland has changed since 2014, that's probably a better campaign strategy, is to try to be a kind of non-party insurgency against an SNP government, which has been in power for more than a decade.
But you'd still have political leaders itching to get involved, wouldn't you? So it would have to some degree, have some kind of cross-party agreement and agreement on strategy.
To an extent. I mean, I think, there will be politicians this time, but I think one of the lessons, both of the Scottish referendum and again the Brexit referendum, is that personalities emerge from these campaigns. You think of the various Remain people who are not politicians, who are now kind of national figures with big media following. The same thing happened in Scotland. So I think it's important, given these are political campaigns, to have people who are politically savvy. But you can create a kind of, a cadre of political spokespeople as well.
But you would still have, I guess, Nicola Sturgeon fronting the Yes campaign if it happened while she was still First Minister. And you would need somebody to be the opposite number to that. And I wonder who you think that might end up being.
I think Alistair, like myself, would probably view that he's done his shift. we were both, I think, like 1,000 days of campaigning from 2012 to 2014. On Boris Johnson, I think it's important to remember in 2014, the thing that David Cameron did well was that he boxed clever. He consistently refused to be the villain that Alex Salmond wanted him to be. He consistently refused to engage every time the SNP said, well, you should debate with Alex Salmond. It should be the Prime Minister of England, Prime Minister of England, as they would say it, but as the rest of the UK, versus the First Minister of Scotland. And that was about trying to, again, create that frame that it was Scotland v Britain or Scotland v England. I think Boris Johnson would be wise to try to emulate David Cameron in that way and stay in the background. This has to be a campaign led by Scots in Scotland, as it was in 2014.
What do you think, looking back on NDRF1, as we'll now call it, what did the Better Together campaign really screw up? Was there anything where you think, actually, if we had a clean slate again and we had another run at this, we wouldn't do that?
We would have tried more to think beyond the referendum. The Conservative Party came out of the referendum in Scotland with an organisational plan of how the electorate would change and how they would exploit that. I think the Labour Party didn't. We didn't really have a sense of how the electorate would be changed by the experience and what the Labour Party's plan for taking advantage of that what would be. And the implication of that has been that, again, for the Labour Party, the SNP have eaten our lunch in terms of people who voted yes, and then the Conservative Party have eaten many of the no voters that we had, and we're kind of left in the middle of the road, getting run over by traffic from both directions. So I think, although arguably it really wasn't my job to do that, I think looking back in terms of securing Scotland's place in the Union, having a clearer strategy for what it meant for the Labour Party as the only party which could replace the SNP is something we should have put a lot more thought into.
Looking at the other side, what do you make of how match fit or referendum fit the SNP are? And also the other parties in Scotland as well. How, if this were to happen, is everybody ready?
No, they're not. No one is. We have all of the ingredients, we have all of the arguments, but we don't have someone to cook those arguments. We've got Gordon Brown still on the pitch, sort of slugging away, to mix my sporting metaphors. But we do need to develop a new generation of political voices. And I think actually a lot of the new people who will come in the Holyrood elections will start to take care of that. On the other side, you still have Nicola Sturgeon as a very gifted communicator at the top of the SNP. But behind her, her entire party is wandering all over the political map. She's lost control of the policy-making apparatus of her party to some pretty eccentric people. There is a real problem with the SNP, and people I think noticed that there is a personality clash going on in the SNP as a result of the Salmond sort of inquiry and the fallout from the Alex Salmond affair. I think what's been less well noticed is that there's a big clash on policy there, yeah, as well, between Nicola Sturgeon trying, kind of in the face of events, to maintain the idea that leaving the UK is a mixture of continuity, so keeping everything you like, and change, getting rid of everything you don't like. And then this sort of insurgency in her own party, partially organising around the Alex Salmond issue, who want to put to the voters a vision which is a much greater upheaval.
But on the unionist side, is Douglas Ross ready, Scottish Conservative leader, and let's assume Anas Sarwar becomes Scottish Labour leader, is he ready as well?
On Douglas Ross, I have no idea whether he's ready or not. I don't think... So Ruth Davidson was very comfortable making an argument which was not contingent on what Boris Johnson felt, because she didn't like Boris Johnson. It was fairly obvious. Douglas Ross hasn't found a language to do that yet, and I think that's really important to find that language for the side that wants to remain in the UK, because you've got to be able to use all of the issues around Brexit as a cautionary tale against leaving a union rather than making it the reason to leave the union. Anas, I think, will win the Scottish Labour leadership. And for the first time in a long time, we'll have someone who is really up for the fight. And I think a mixture of Anas being up for the fight again and Keir Starmer having shown, you know, a real interest in this issue with the constitutional work that he and Gordon Brown are doing, I think there's a chance of the Labour Party getting back onto the pitch in a serious way, which is encouraging. I think the Conservative Party have a bigger problem, though.
Are you a betting man, Blair?
No, I'm not.
You are today.
I am for these purposes, yeah.
So assume Indy Ref 2 happens next year, what would the result be? Be it yes or no, leave remain?
It would be a vote to remain in the UK.
Confident?
Extremely confident. The people of Scotland are not going to vote to cut public services, to put up a new border with England, and to change currency. They are simply not going to vote for that.
That was Blair MacDougall, who ran the Better Together campaign in 2014 in the Scottish independence referendum.
John Pienaar at Drive, this afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
We're going to be talking about the news. We're going to be discussing it and explaining it.
Join John Pienaar for the Drive Time show dedicated to the news that matters and the views that need to be heard.
I'm going to give people the time and space to tell us what they think. And I'm not going to tell you what to think. I'm going to help you make up your mind.
Trusted news, insight and opinion that speaks for itself. John Pienaar at Drive, this afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
This is Times Radio.
Where we're joined by Blair Jenkins, who was chief executive of the Yes campaign in the 2014 Scottish independence referendum. Hello.
Good morning, Luke.
Thank you very much for your time today and allowing us to continue our Blair referendum project. We just heard from Blair MacDougall, who was, I guess, your sort of nemesis, your opposite number in 2014. I'm interested, when I started talking to him and I asked, first of all, how likely does he think a second independence referendum is? He seems pretty convinced that there wouldn't be one. What do you think?
Well, it all depends on what happens in the Scottish election, which is exactly 11 weeks from today on May 6th. I think if the SNP and Greens, who are the two pro-independence parties, if they win a majority, and every opinion poll is suggesting that they will, then the question of a second independence referendum is the defining issue in the Scottish election. There's no doubt about that. We all know that. It's the defining issue. Should we or should we not have a second independence referendum? If the SNP come out of that having won it fair and square, and with that as a central issue, there will have to be a second Scottish independence referendum. So whatever bluster we hear now, it would simply be to obstruct or deny democracy if that were to be the clear result in a fair and square election, and there were any attempt not to implement the result of the election. So I think a lot of what's being said by Boris Johnson and others is posturing pre-election. And I think the weight of argument, the democratic force of saying there has to be a second referendum if people in Scotland vote to have one, the people decide, then there'll be one.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment. Let's go back to 2014, first of all, and lessons learned. I asked Blair MacDougall similar questions. I'm keen to know what your view is of the campaign you ran. First of all, things that went well, things that if you were to be in charge of Indy Ref 2, you would wholesale copy.
I think the style of the campaign was absolutely right. We said it would be a campaign unlike anything that Scottish politics or British politics had seen before. It was very community-based, very local. It was very much focused on grassroots, on conversations that people were having at a local level. And that worked very, very well. In the week I was appointed, I was asked to be chief executive of the Yes campaign. A poll came out that week which had the independents vote at 27% in the summer of 2012. Now, as people know, 2 years later in 2014, that had grown to 45%. And of course, as people may also know, look, the polls now are showing pro-independence support at 54%. Mm. So it's literally double what it was when we started back in 2012. So I think that style of campaign, very much community-based, very local, very positive, very inclusive, I think the tone and style of the campaign would be the same.
But on tone, were you not worried, and would you not want to rectify the situation where there was quite a vicious edge, wasn't there, especially online?
Well, I think that has been overstated. And the reason why some people have overstated it is because they want to say, well, you know, it was such a terribly divisive thing. You wouldn't want to do that again. The actual truth is, it was a tiny number of people relative to the people who voted, the millions who voted. You're talking about a tiny number, literally a couple of hundred people on both sides who were misbehaving on social media. And it was almost all on social media, in the streets and in the public meetings, in the town halls and things. And I was all over the country taking part in this. And everything was done in a very courteous and respectful way.
Didn't Jim Murphy have something thrown at him?
Well, you see, but you're right, Luke. But of course, that is the one and only example people can point to, is that someone threw an egg at Jim Murphy. Now, I'm not condoning egg throwing at Jim or anyone else. But if you think about, for instance, how much more bitter and divisive and occasionally physical the Brexit campaign and its aftermath were, then the Scottish referendum, as the Electoral Commission said in their report, was a model for all future referendums in the UK.
If the No campaign was too head and not enough heart, some people suggested that the Yes campaign was too heart and not enough head. Would you agree with that, and would you want to tweak the balance between the two if you were to run the referendum again later?
Well, that is an interesting point. The truth about the Scottish referendum is that we did go into an incredible amount of detail, extraordinary detail, about what an independent Scotland would be like. And as is probably known, I mean, more or less everybody in Scotland temporarily became an expert on currency in the course of the 2014 election. You know, you could get into a taxi cab and the driver would be talking to you knowledgeably about what a fully convertible currency is or what a reserve currency is. And so, you know, the level of engagement and debate was quite fantastic. And it brought so many young people into politics on both sides. And we're still seeing that level of engagement in Scotland. So I think emotionally, the pitch was right. We set out to be very positive, as I say, very, you know, respectful, very inclusive. And I think we succeeded in that. What will really change in this campaign that's coming, I think, that the huge difference between then and now is, of course, Brexit.
Yes.
That's what's transformed the position. Because, and again, I know, you know, your listeners elsewhere in the UK may not fully appreciate this, just how big an issue the European Union was in the first Scottish referendum. It was literally the main argument used by the No campaign to discourage people from voting for independence. I mean, I took part in debates with just about every leading figure on the other side, in town halls, in broadcasting studios and so on. It was always the first or one of the very first things brought up. If you vote for independence, you won't be in the European Union. And one of the things that has shifted opinion so much in Scotland has been the fact that, not just the fact that that Brexit happened, which is, you know, as you know, we voted 62% to remain in the European Union. It's not just the fact of Brexit, but because I think it was such a big issue in 2014. I was talking recently to an academic from overseas who was looking into, in particular, why the women, the percentage of women in Scotland who support independence has increased very markedly. Women in Scotland are now more pro-yes than men, which is a reverse of the 2014 situation. And she was telling me that the big change for women was the sense of betrayal about 2014. They felt they were told the way to secure that you'll stay part of the European Union is to vote against independence. And that sense of betrayal and that sense that we are now out of the European Union and the only way back in for Scotland, the only way back into the EU is to vote for independence.
But what has that done to the economic case, the UK now being out of the EU? Because then, if I'm imagining the sort of a second independence referendum now, what does that do to questions about the border, about currency? That's all just got a lot more complicated, hasn't it, for the proponents of Yes?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, if anything, I mean, most of the pundits, the experts, seem to think that the UK coming out of the EU has actually shifted the balance in the economic debate. I mean, I believe I didn't want Brexit to happen, and I was strongly against Brexit happening. I wish it hadn't happened, but it is now and will going forward inflict a lot of economic damage on the UK. So, in terms of which is the riskier option, I think that's something that people have begun to think about in Scotland, and it's one of the things that's making people more open to independence and changing their minds.
But I just wonder about what we're seeing about the border on the island of Ireland and things like that. And if the Scotland says, OK, we'll vote for independence, but we want to rejoin the EU in the single market, does that mean, you know, customs checks and things on the border between Scotland and England? All of that kind of debate comes into play, doesn't it?
Well, I think that you're right. That will form part of the discussion, is what will the arrangements be. But as we've seen in the end, despite their best efforts, the UK government were actually able to get a deal in the end with the European Union on what the relationships would be going forward. And I'm in no doubt that there would be special arrangements in place between Scotland and England, as it is on the island of Ireland. I'm sure that everyone would want to have good, open and free flowing trade going forward. But it's an interesting thing. You know, we one of the arguments that's sometimes made is against Scottish independence is the fact that so much of our trade is with the rest of the UK. It's about 63-64% of our trade by value is with the rest of the UK. Mm. But if one looks at Canada, 75% of their trade, of their export trade, is to the United States. And I can tell you, there is no campaign in Canada to become part of the United States. You know, you don't have to be absorbed into your biggest trading partner. So I think the economic argument, which I would have said was probably fought to a draw in 2014, I wouldn't say we won the economic argument. I think we held our own on that front. We won on every other aspect of the debate. But I think the economic argument has shifted towards the Yes campaign.
Blair Jenkins, would you like to make a bet with us?
Yes.
About it. I guess we've already had the question of the likelihood of a second independence referendum, but I'm keen to know what you think the result would be. Blair McDougall was adamant it would be no. He thinks that the case has been strengthened for no.
Well, all our experience is that when you get in front of people and when you have the discussion, the movement is towards yes. That's been the experience of this issue has dominated Scottish life, Scottish politics for the last 10 years. So I'm confident that once we actually start the independence debate, the independence campaign properly, the movement would be towards yes, and Scotland will vote in favour of independence.
And that was Blair Jenkins, who ran Yes Scotland in 2014 in the Scottish independence referendum. Before that, we heard from Blair McDougall, who was chief executive of the Better Together campaign. That is all we've got time for on the Redbox podcast. Remember, you can like and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from, and you can listen to us on the Times Radio app. In fact, I've realised the whole week of doing this podcast while Matt has been away, I haven't plugged my own show on Times Radio enough. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, breakfast, 6 a.m. till 10 a.m. You're stuck at home, you haven't got anything better to do, so you may as well tune in. Don't worry, Matt will be back next week. In the meantime, do subscribe to the Redbox email every day. thetimes.co.uk/subscribe is where you need to go.